You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hi, and welcome to The Compass, the podcast documenting the struggles of life as an artist. I'm Leah Walsh. My guest today is Carrie Preston. Carrie is a wonderful actor as well as a director, writer, and producer. She's a fellow graduate of both the University of Evansville and the Juilliard School, and she's someone whose drive I've admired for a very long time. She's had a successful acting career, but really what we talk about in this conversation are all the ways that she's created her own work, her own art outside of her mainstream work. She has a production company, she's directing short films all the time, she's writing scripts, and it's really inspiring to me the way she really makes her creative life extremely full. She also does a lot of work with the New Harmony Project, which is a new play development conference which I've worked with in the past and I really admire. So I hope you enjoy the conversation. Happy New Year to everyone. 2017 was an extremely difficult year in so many ways. There was also a lot of growth, and I'm looking forward to a new one. So I'm wishing you all the best, and I hope you enjoy the 103rd episode of The Compass. The first question that I always start with is, what do you do to keep from going to the dark side as an artist?
I just stay incredibly busy, you know, creatively, and I'm like a little hummingbird, you know. I don't light for too long on something, and I guess that would include dark thoughts. So I try to remain active creatively, but also just, you know, socially, you know, intellectually, physically. But I also, you know, have a very cursory kind of knowledge or understanding of Buddhism. Mm. And I find that that's a very helpful thing to have as an artist, you know, that idea that, you know, we are all in the same place, and that suffering is sort of part of the human condition. Uh-huh. You know, and I count sadness, I guess, among that, you know, suffering, and that, you know, if you try to fight it, it only makes it worse. You know, so there's that thing about just sort of accepting it. And
yeah. When did that kind of come into your life?
I mean, I guess, you know, my parents were very non-traditional in their... I grew up in the South, but they were definitely not traditionally religious in any way. So we didn't go to any churches or anything, but they were very much into, like, alternative kind of spiritual stuff. So I guess it was kind of in my life as something that I could have gravitated to, you know, anyway. And then I would say once I got to New York and I was up here and there was a lot of chaos, I started, like, looking for, you know, kind of a spiritual anchor in some way. And I knew I wasn't going to be in the traditional church. And I tried, you know, other things like Science of Mind and, you know, not Scientology. That's a totally different thing. Totally different thing. Never tried that. But, you know, Science of Mind was this thing that they had at Avery Fisher Hall. Hmm. They would have these Sunday services at Avery Fisher Hall, which was right at Lincoln Center.
Right.
And so I started going to those. And it was very, you know, sort of...
More the self-helpy,
yeah,
world.
I guess new agey, mm-hmm, kind of vibe, which was cool, but it still wasn't really doing it for me, you know. And then I started reading books by Pema Chodron,
yeah,
you know, and everybody, you know, just kept saying you got to check her out, stuff.
Yeah.
So I've
had so many people say that.
Yeah. So
once
I started reading her books,
yeah,
I was like, oh, okay, because she makes it so accessible to Westerners. And then I've been to, like, a weekend where she spoke, you know, at the Omega Institute, mm-hmm, and found that to be really wonderful. And, you know, I do my best to meditate. I'm not good at sitting still, as I started off telling you.
Yeah.
So that's definitely a challenge for me. But when I can sit still, you know, when I allow myself to sit still, yeah. I find that it keeps me from, you know, going to the dark side.
Yeah. Well, I mean, those are things that could be helpful to anyone in any walk of life, but it really is particular to artists. I feel like there's so much self-scrutiny that's involved, or can be, if you kind of let yourself go down an unhealthy road in pursuing mm-hmm. this as a career.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it's particularly helpful.
Yeah, it is. And, well, I mean, it's sort of part of our job requirement, actually, yeah. is to scrutinize ourselves. I mean, because we have to understand what all the millions of tools are that we have in our bodies, which is what we use to build our characters. So it makes sense that we would get caught in that. It makes sense that lines get crossed when you're playing a role and you kind of get a little confused as to who's thinking the thoughts, you know? And you see why people turn to substance. You see why mm-hmm. people, you know, turn to other people. You see why people destroy, you know, marriages. Like, you know, you see all, it makes complete sense when you think about what it is that we choose to do with our lives. You know, we're walking around with nerve endings in front of us,
yeah.
leading us through the world.
Yeah.
They're not inside us. They're right out.
Completely exposed.
They're right out on the outside. Yeah.
Well, from the outside, you're someone who's had a lot of success within the business of being an actor, within mm-hmm. the structure of being an actor.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm particularly interested in the things you've been doing that are self-motivated, kind of outside of the major TV stuff you've done and things like your production company and
yeah.
New Harmony Project and stuff like that.
Yeah.
The things that have really been able to keep you busy between roles where someone else is
yeah.
you know, giving you the paycheck.
Exactly. Yeah, no, it I guess it was around 2004. So I had been out of grad school and in the profession for, you know, a good decade, and you know, I was doing my thing and making my living and mm-hmm. very grateful for that. But I realized there was something that was atrophied in me, you know, because I had kind of given my power to other people.
Yeah.
You know, to tell me that it was okay for me to do what it is that I want to do with my life. You know. And sometimes they would pay me and sometimes they wouldn't, but still I was going to them and saying, can I do this thing?
Right.
You know, and
or, this is what you should do. This is what you are.
Right. This is what you are. Or, you know, I would like to play this part. No, you can't play that part, you know, or yeah, you can play this part, but only for a month, you know, or mm-hmm. whatever it is, you know. So I just thought, okay, I just have more that I want to say in the world and with my life, and I want to just see if I can figure out how to get the tools to do that, you know. So I just started I got a grant through the Fox Foundation, which mm-hmm. was at that time giving grants to actors to do continuing education in some way. It had to do with your acting. So I was like, okay, but I want to like study filmmaking. So I kind of tricked it into a thing where I took a filmmaking class, but then I went and took an on-camera acting class at the same time so that I could say, you see, what I'm learning behind the camera is going
right.
to help me with what's in front of the camera. And yeah. that's true. It's very true.
Where did you take the class?
So it was through the New York Film Academy, but they have these campuses all over the world, really. And I went to the campus at Universal Studios in LA.
Because
mm-hmm. At the time I was kind of, you know, trying to dig up work out there. So I've always been kind of doing the bi-coastal thing. And plus I just thought it would be cool you got to go shoot on the back lot at Universal as a student, you know, which is pretty cool. Like yeah. you're on the, you know, Western set, you know, you're on these like iconic sets mm-hmm. and you're a student, you know, and you've got a camera in your hand on the first day. So I did this like really intense 5-week course, and this was pre-digital, okay? So we're shooting on like Super 8, Super 16. We're shooting on film. and then we're cutting on film.
Nice.
So they're teaching us how to cut old school, you know, and this was not that long ago.
It's changed so fast.
This was right in the digital revolution, right? So it was like right as it was happening. So it was cool to learn how to edit by hand with tape and, you know, you'd make the splice and you cut it and you put it through the machine. And it was really cool. So when we got into digital nonlinear editing, it was nice to have that tool. You know, it's that sort of idea of if you know how to do Shakespeare, then you can do a commercial, you know? So it was like, okay, if you know how to like cut in a linear way, then that's going to help you so much, you know, when you're directing or whatever. But so anyway, I did that. And then my friend of mine from Juilliard, James Vasquez, he was in my class at Juilliard, and he was like, hey, I wrote this script and, you know, nobody's going to give me money to do it, but maybe we could figure out how to do it together since you've been studying filmmaking. So we literally got one of those little mini DV digital cameras and we taught ourselves everything. His now husband, partner, Mark Holmes. And so, you know, the three of us just did everything. I directed it. James wrote it. He was in it. We got our friends to be in it. Mark shot it with me. Mark and James cut it. We all, you know, we just like got in there and learned how to do it. And we ended up piecing together this feature film and we sold it and, you know, it went to tons of festivals and then we just reinvested in the next thing. And
that's amazing that you sold the first one that you did.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't for much, you know, but we didn't make it for much, you know? So, you know, that's the kind of trick with indie filmmaking is that you certainly can't roll the dice thinking you're going to make a lot of money. You know, they're just those ones that sell for the millions at Sundance are very few, you know? So we kind of learned that no budget filmmaking style. And I actually really prefer it, you know, because you just have more control and it's crazy. It's like putting on a community theater play in a way, you know, it's just, there's cameras there and, you know, it's a little more expensive, but, you know, so we did that and then we kind of got off on that, you know, we liked that feeling of like, hey, we had a story to tell and we wanted to, you know, do it. So we figured it out. And this was like right at the beginning when everyone else was doing that too. And now of course you can shoot a movie on your iPhone and there's problems with that too, because of course now we have too much content, you know,
it's hard to even find anything.
It's like Horton Hears a Who, you know, you can't get the word out, you know, you cannot get the word out. It's really, really hard. Even a major, major television show is having a hard time getting audiences because we're all just screaming for the same people. But at that time, when we started doing it, you know, there was still an eager audience that was being kind of underfed. And so that, you know, really really fed us, you know, to be able to feed them. So.
And you guys have continued. Are you actively making anything right now?
Yes, I'm actively making something right now. yeah, we're constantly doing stuff. James has been doing a lot of theater. He directs a lot of theater now.
Is he here in New York? He's
in San Diego. Yeah, yeah. So they live in San Diego, and that's kind of our base, our hub there. And then I've been sort of doing the New York end of things, so... the last thing I did was a kind of a doc, live concert stand-up sketch show that I recorded of Kate Rigg, who's a brilliant comedian, and she also has a band, and she does these live shows. So I filmed her live show over like three different performances, and then I took her, she has character comedy too, and then I took her characters out on location. And I shot them, and then I cut it all together into this weird, like, concert indie movie. It's called Happy, Lucky, Golden, Tofu, Panda, Dragon, Good Time, Fun, Fun Show.
So where can one see this?
It did all these festivals, and then we haven't, you know, we got exhausted with the whole self-distribution thing. So I think we're probably just going to throw it up on Amazon or something, you know, because you can self, you know, promote now and you can self-distribute and It's just a lot of work, but you can do it, you know? So we're probably heading towards that. But yeah, and then I'm actually just trying to legit get into television, like legit television, like as a director and producer and writer. So I've got a couple of different projects that I'm trying to get going. One of them I wrote, so it's, you know, being sent around as a, you know, just a script. Mm-hmm. And then one of them, Lynn Rosen wrote, who wrote this web series that I direct called Darwin.
Yes.
And
we had Carl Kensler on that, but I don't remember what episode number.
That's right. Mm-hmm. I remember that he did that. Yeah, so she was one of the writers on Darwin, and so she wrote this pilot that is really fun and is great, but a lot of people in Hollywood don't really like to read. So, and this is a high, kind of a high concept script. Okay. So, so I'm shooting a proof of concept for it. So basically I'm shooting the first 8 pages.
That's just an easier way to pitch it.
Yeah. Because then it's like, here,
this is the tone.
This is the first
this is the
7 or 8 minutes of this thing, this half hour show.
That's
this is the world. This is what it's going to feel like, you know, on in its lower budget form, but this is the idea. And you know, do you want to hear more? Do you want to read the script? Do you want to see, you know? So it'll be like a little selling tool.
Yeah.
Plus it was just fun, you know, for us to just see if it even works, you know, and it's a good way to kind of test that out, you know, to see what comes up off the page and, you know, how is this concept even viable? I mean, I think it will be. But it's, you know, a great way to kind of do it with way lower stakes.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. Have you gotten into directing, in theater as well, or is it mostly been drawn to film stuff?
Yeah, I've done theater in the past, and I have a couple of projects that really, and one in particular that really, really has been speaking to me for a couple of years now, and I've directed some workshops and readings of it, and now, we're at the, in the process of trying to get a theater somewhere in America interested in letting us do it. not the easiest thing to do, but certainly not in New York City, but it's a really cool script. It's written by Susan Ferrara, and it's called Buzz, and it's about Marianne Buzz Goodbody, who in the early 1970s was only one of three female directors in the UK. She was with the RSC, and she had been chugging away there, you know, for a long time and doing these, like, really cool experimental things, but, you know, couldn't get the big break, you know, and they basically just kind of tossed her a shed and, like, well, you could go direct over there if you want, some scene study. And so she went over to this shed, and she turned it into a theater, and she did Hamlet, and she cast then unknown, basically he was a spear carrier for the company, Ben Kingsley as Hamlet. And so anyway, that place then became The Other Place, which was their huge alternative space at the RSC. Mm-hmm. So anyway, this is a story about her, and it's also a story about Hamlet. So it's like this interesting, you know, combo of a theatrical piece about a woman's journey as a professional in a man's world, and then a man, you know, Hamlet sort of searching for his place in the world, and, you know, how those things intertwine, and really the glass ceiling. What happens when you repeatedly hit the glass ceiling?
Yeah.
And that's what happened to Buzz. So it's a really cool story.
I want to see it.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about any sexism that you faced as an actor, or now that you're trying to be a director? Have you found that it's difficult? I know there's just not a lot of directors being hired.
Yeah, but I think the times are changing. Obviously, we're in a big moment right now, and it's great to see that women are coming together and supporting each other and trying to make this moment actionable instead of just reactionable, you know. Mm-hmm. People are really trying to put things to the test and, you know, putting networks and agencies and studios to the test and saying, listen, you know, you got to promise us that by 2020, we're going to have 50-50. You know, like we have a goal here.
Yeah.
You know, and let's go for it. Let's have parity, you know, let's have, and I don't know if we're going to be able to reach it in 2 years, but it's good to kind of have this goal, you know, and to see leaders that are really, leaders, female leaders in the industry who are really vocal about that. And, you know, I'm doing my best to try to change that, you know, but it is a man's world, but I don't know. I just keep on doing my thing, and it can be infuriating, but I feel, you know, fortunate that I haven't experienced some of the really horrible things that some of the people have experienced that have been speaking out.
Yeah.
But, you know, we all as women experience sexism daily, you know.
It's really exciting to me, like the Kilroy's list and, yeah, people putting down lines in the sand about parity. It does, I have a lot of hope for it, but then in the back of my mind, I think I'm also scared that it's just going to fade away.
Yeah, it'll.
Because people's attention spans are so short.
Yeah.
People are like, oh, you're still talking about that?
You're still talking. Oh, you guys, shut up. You just shut up. Yeah.
But like, it is exciting to think that this might be a moment of not gradual change, but fast change.
What is that, Tina, in Tina Fey's book, Bossy Pants? Did you read that?
It's been a long time since I have.
So, like, I'm like, I feel like in the first page or something, she says, I feel like the definition, is it bitch? The definition of bitch in Hollywood is when a woman still keeps talking even after you stop wanting to fuck her. So people get mad when women keep talking.
That's true.
They just don't want us to keep talking. You know, they're just like, you already said that. Now shut up, you know? But I think we're at a point where we're actually going to not stop, you know? And we're just going to keep on talking. And we've got strength in numbers, I think, right now, which is good too. And it's a tough hurdle, but I don't know. I'm a fighter.
Can we talk a little bit about the New Harmony Project?
Yes, please.
Because so the New Harmony Project is a new play development conference in Indiana where Carrie and I actually met years ago.
Yes.
It's closely associated with Evansville, where we both went to school. But you've been on the board now for a number of years.
Yeah. I guess my first time I went there, I was still a student. I was in grad school. I was at Juilliard, but I went back, you know, to do a summer there. And then I joined the board, I don't know, like 14 years ago now or 15 years ago. And you do two three-year terms, then you have to rotate off.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can come back on for 6 years if you want. So I did that. I did 6 years, and then I rotated off, and then I did 6 years, and then I'm currently rotated off right now.
Okay.
But, you know, they asked me on the yearly if I'll come back, and I will eventually, but, you know, it takes a lot of time, you know, it's a time commitment.
Yeah.
And, you know, I needed a little time to focus on other stuff, but I'm totally there for them at all times, and I'm very happy with what's happening right now artistically. We've got a big change, and so it's kind of exciting to see that we keep growing, you know, this 30 plus year now organization. It keeps on kicking in a time when nonprofit organizations like that have such an intangible product, you know,
mm-hmm.
Can still be viable and supported and funded, and writers can come there and have a safe environment to develop works that send a positive message out into the world. You know, there's not very many places, I don't know of any other place that's that specific of a mission.
How do you think that definition has changed over the time you've been involved of what, or I'm not exactly sure of the wording in the mission statement, positive?
Yeah, it has changed. It has changed because the times have changed, you know. I think the original mission statement is still in our website. It's very poetic and long and gorgeous, and not meant for the digital age, you know. it was written 32 years ago, I guess. Right. By Walt Wongeren and Jeff Sparks and John David Lutz and all the, you know, founding mm-hmm. members of the organization. And it a lot of people, I think, originally interpreted it as sort of a religious,
like a
wholesome
thing, yeah,
kind of thing, or Christian maybe. Although those words were never used, it was just sort of like when you start talking about positive, somehow people go to, oh, well, that must mean, you know, Christian. Not that that's a bad thing at all, mm-hmm. but I think it kind of limited people's understanding of what that is, and what a script that is life-affirming means, you know. A lot of times I think people thought, oh, well, I guess that means we can't have any sadness or conflict or anything. Well, of course, you can't create a piece of theater or movie or anything without conflict. Like, that's mm-hmm. how great pieces of literature are created, conflict, you know. So I sort of look at it as, like, neoclassical, you know. I kind of look at it like, you know, Arthur Miller would have been a great New Harmony playwright, you know. Thornton Wilder, you know, and he wrote some weird plays in there, you know. We always had really interesting debates as to, is this a New Harmony script or isn't it?
Yeah,
you know, what
sure.
is it, you know, what does it mean? And I think they're great, healthy discussions about what that means. And we've had some pieces that have been devastating, you know, to watch, but ultimately redemptive, you know. There was hope in the midst of despair, which was, you know, one of the lines in the original mission statement, that we were looking for pieces that, you know, had hope in the midst of despair. And that always spoke to me, you know, as a real goal in art, you know, to offer us as humans some kind of hope, you know.
Yeah.
Because there's enough despair in the world.
Yeah, I think it's really beautiful what New Harmony does in supporting new plays and writers, and not being product driven. Like, they're not,
yeah.
they don't need to finish the play in the 2 weeks that they're
right.
there.
Right. No.
It's really just an incubator.
Right.
And like a welcome place. Here, we'll take care of you. We'll try to make this atmosphere that'll help your creativity.
Yeah, I always say, you know, we don't invest in plays, we invest in people mm-hmm. at New Harmony, because the play may or may not ever go on. And we've had plays that have been developed there that have gone to Broadway, that have been turned into movies, that have gone, you know, to quote-unquote success, you know. Mm-hmm. And then we've had some that just haven't, but the people have. You know, the people keep on, and the people, you know, continue to create stuff, and we were a part of the nurturing of their creative fiber, you know, and the fabric of their creative life. And I just think it's important and necessary, you know, for writers to have that. You know, you go, okay, Apple, they don't just like come out with an iPhone, you know, they have to develop it. They have to put money into it. They have to nurture it. They have to work it out. They have to figure it out. They have to have a place where they can, you know. So if you think about a writer in the same way, they need that, you know. People think, oh, well, writers are just going to go sit in their living room and come up with something by themselves. Well, maybe a novel, maybe. But when you're talking about the performing arts, you got to have the other people.
Yeah.
You got to have those other voices, you know.
Yeah, for sure. Can I ask what your family thinks of you choosing to be an artist for your career?
Well, my mother's an artist.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, she's a visual artist. Mm-hmm. When we were growing up, she did a lot of watercolors. She's a sculptor. And then later, when we got older, she got into what is essentially art therapy. She calls it expressive art. And she started working with... different people from different walks of life who needed kind of supplemental help, whether they were had you know, been abused as a child, or they were just in therapy and they wanted to have something to supplement that, or you know, they had substance abuse or something like that. And she started using art in a therapeutic way. So she did that for a while. She would go to hospitals and she would work with people in hospitals, and she would have private clients and stuff. So we, you know, my brother and sister and I, we grew up in a, you know, a very artistically supported household, and art was very much revered and appreciated in our house. And my brother is an actor as well, John Preston. He does.
And you guys have done some stuff.
We've done a lot of stuff together, and you know, we grew up doing plays together, and you know, he's been in some of our movies, Daisy Three Pictures, my production company.
Is he here in New York?
He lives in New York. And
oh, nice.
He works all over the country, you know, so he's in and out of town. He's a gypsy like all of us. Yeah. And my sister, she ended up studying art history. And then she studied library science. And she works at FIT, Fashion Institute of Technology. She's the head of acquisitions in their library.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, but before that, she worked at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in one of their libraries. So, you know, we've got a lot of art.
Very artistic.
Yeah. So luckily, my parents, my dad was a geotechnical engineer, so he was very, very left-brained, but never questioned our choices.
He could appreciate it.
He did, and he just, you know, wanted us to pursue what we were passionate about. Thankfully, he didn't say, oh, you need to go and, you know, go to law school or something. Like, he was very, very supportive. And of course, my mom too. So, you know, they have these now three children who live in New York City, and you know, we're all involved in the arts.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
We don't have to talk about this if you don't want to, but I was wondering, since your husband's also an actor, kind of how you guys have found a way to deal with being apart a lot, or just dealing with each other's artistic lives.
Yeah. Well, you know, Michael and I have been together for 23 years, and we, you know, we met when we were both just poor little theater church mice, you know, trying to eke out a living. And so we had this, you know, rule where it was like, okay, we have to see each other every 2 months.
Yes.
You know, and it was like our rule. It was like the 2 month rule, you know, and we really stuck to that.
That seems expensive.
Oh, it was really rough. Yeah. It was really hard to make that work.
Yes.
But, you know, so we were like the 2 month rule, and then, you know, we started to get to a place where we were, you know, getting a little more work and stuff. And then it was like, okay, 6 weeks. We got the 6 week rule. Knocked it down to 6 weeks. Knocked it down to a month. Now we're at the 2 week.
Nice.
Yeah, we're at the 2 week thing.
That's fantastic.
So we don't always get to do that. We, you know, just logistically, it's challenging, and schedules, and where's Waldo, you know, in the world kind of thing. But we definitely try to stick with the 2 week rule, which helps.
Yeah.
We're not big. We're kind of old fashioned. We're not big on the FaceTime or the Skype, but we just kind of do the phone thing and the texting, and you know, we kind of do this, this listening to each other's voice. I probably, because we've been together so long, that's how it all started, you know, before the cell phones, you know. It was like the phone, that was our deal.
Both
so
understand when your schedules are insane.
Yeah
To talk for a couple of days,
so that helps. You know, we talk, you know, before you go to bed, you know, you have to, it's all about just keeping that communication going when you're apart.
Yeah.
You know, having like dedicated phone dates, you know, making sure, okay, we're going to get together this time. We're going to, I don't know. We just, that thing about if you're cool with yourself and what you're doing in your own life, and you're not dependent on the other person, then it's so much better for you, I think, for us anyway.
For your relationship.
Yeah, for our relationship, that we both have our lives, and we both have our approach to our careers, which is completely different. And yet we just like each other. you know, and we like just like to be together, spend time together. So when we're apart, it makes the being together all the better. You know, we appreciate it. You know, we don't take it for granted.
Right.
Because we're not in each other's faces all the time.
Is there a lesson you've learned in the last couple years that you're really proud of that you want to tell me about?
A lesson?
Yeah, it could be something big or something small, but or it's something you've figured out and changed the way you do something. Or
let's see. I feel like, I feel like I continue to try to learn the lesson of, you know, how to hold on loosely. You know that song, yeah. Hold On Loosely, but Don't Let Go? You know,
that's a good one.
It's a tough one to get because I'm, you know, I tend to want to hold on to something. You know, I'm pretty tenacious. My friends call me Tenacious P because I will get a hold of a thing and I won't want to let go, you know? And so that includes also, you know, being attached to like an idea of something, how something should be. You know, so I was doing this job and I had this, I was really attached to like the of what it was going to be, like the result, what the situation was going to be and what the result was going to be. And I was very clear, you know, with people at the beginning about this is what I want from this. You know, I was very clear with everybody involved. And then it didn't turn out that way.
Uh-huh.
And I still didn't let go. And I got, you know, I just sort of gripped tighter and made myself a little miserable and made maybe some other people a little miserable too. And then I realized, oh, you know, I needed to go through that so that I could then let go of a result and actually enjoy the process more. So
yeah.
I couldn't have gone, if I hadn't done that, if I hadn't gripped so hard to that, it's gotta be this way, then I don't think I would have learned that lesson because, you know, you just, if you white knuckle the things, it's finally just gonna break, you know?
Well, we all have a sense of like justice.
Yes.
The way things should be.
Yes.
And of, oh, I did everything right.
I did everything right.
Out this way.
Exactly. And I told them and I said that this was what I wanted and they still didn't give it to me. And, you know.
And it can be unfair, but it's not gonna help you.
No, it's not gonna help.
To hold on to it.
It's not gonna help the situation get any. It's just this is the way it's going to be. And it's that thing. And I guess you could apply that even to, like, the actual, like, say, apply that to a scene that you're doing, an acting scene, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to play this scene this way. And I'm going to, you know, this is my objective. And this is what I'm going to get this person to do. And this is what, you know what I'm saying? That's not going to yield anything that's going to be very interesting to watch.
Yes.
You know?
And the other person might be doing something.
They're going to be doing, of course. And if you're not paying attention to that, if you're not receiving, then there's not going to be any give and take there. And it's going to break, you know? It's just not going to work. So when I got the bigger picture of that, I'm like, oh, okay, it's all the same, you know? What we do and how we approach it, it's kind of the same. How's that for esoteric? Non-specific, specific?
No, I like it.
Okay.
That's a hard one for everyone. Do you have any artistic mentors that have been really important to you in your career?
I find that I can find a mentor in pretty much every working situation. You know, I like to get into a situation and go, who am I going to get something new from? You know, like I was just working on, I'm on this TV show now called Claws. And, you know, when you're doing a TV show, you get a different director pretty much every episode. I mean, sometimes you get, you know, one director that'll do like two or something or three. But you know, you'll get new ones and stuff. So you're constantly having to relearn. You're having to learn somebody's new language. And you can kind of tell pretty quickly if you're going to jive with someone or not, you know, and some of them are way more technical, you know, they're just about the camera and they don't know how to talk to actors, and some of them are all about the actors, and some of them are, you know, right there in the middle. And so I worked with this director, her name is Victoria Mahoney, and she came on and she directed episode 4 of Claws, and she was a powerhouse. I mean, she was so cool and together and smart and articulate, and she would fire everybody up, not just the actors, but, you know, the gaffers, the prop people. She would go into the makeup trailer with all of these collages that she put together, and I'm looking for something like this, and she would just jazz everybody up, you know. And she's just coming in doing one episode of a show that's new, so it hasn't, nobody's right. even seen it, you know, and she's only seen the pilot, you know, because that's the only thing that had been even cut together, you know. So it was like, just to see somebody that was able to come in and take control of hundreds of people that she doesn't know,
that's amazing to me,
and make something interesting was so inspiring to watch. And then the way she worked with us as actors too, she comes from an acting background, so she sort of has that language already in her, but the things that she would do were so special and specific and surprising, you know. And so it's people like that, you know, that I just take inspiration from, and I go, oh, I want to be able to do that. I want to be able to go in and inspire people like that, you know. I mean, look, John David Lutz, our teacher from Evansville. I mean, how long has he been doing what he's been doing?
He's finally retiring this year.
Yeah, and he...
60 years, maybe?
60 years of teaching in that school and directing and inspiring so many students to go on and work. And how many hundreds and hundreds of us are there now?
Right.
You know, because of someone like him, you know? So people like that who can get other people to, I don't know, fire up their own sparks.
Yeah.
That's what, that's what gets me inspired.
Well, I've kept you for a long time, so I just have two quick questions that I always ask at the end. The first one, and you mentioned a few things at the beginning, but if you are having a day where you're feeling really down or uninspired, mm-hmm. are there any concrete things that you reach for again and again, like a book or a place you go or music you listen to or anything like that?
Yeah, well, I mean, going back to Pema Chodron, when things fall apart, like my Bible, so I will go turn to that, or places that scare you, that's another good one. I'll turn to that. I have these goddess cards.
Mm-hmm.
They're called Goddess Guidance. And I will, you know, do like a goddess reading. My friend Trisha Ross gave those to me. And so I'll do a guide.
Are they like tarot cards, kind of?
Kind of, yes. Yeah. Like you can meditate. Like you can do it however you want. But, you know, they're like runes or something, you know, like that. So you can meditate on a question and then you pull out a card. And they're just beautifully written, these cards. And, you know, they're all women, and, you know, so that's something that it's kind of like, you know, a horoscope or something like that,
right.
but just more interesting and just makes you think about your life in a different way. I walk my dog, you know, I do something that is, gets me out of myself where I have to, you know, think about, let's think about somebody else right now.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's do that, you know,
right.
go. Try to help somebody else, you know, help a friend, give thanks. Every day before sleep, I give thanks. That's what I do before I go to bed. I give thanks. I just list the things that I'm thankful for until I fall asleep. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's a good thing as well, because it's really hard when you get tripped up, when you get gripped, like I was just talking about, you forget the things that you do have that, you know, you can be grateful for, and it kind of helps you reset, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. And then the last question is, have you seen anything recently that you want to recommend of any art form?
Well, I just listened to this, speaking of podcasts, mm-hmm. I just listened to Homecoming.
Oh, I haven't listened to that.
It's really, really great. It's, you know, fiction. So it's actors doing it. It's a written script. So it's two seasons. I think it's 6 episodes each. But the actors are amazing. It's got Katherine Keener and David Schwimmer and Oscar Isaac and David Cross. And, like, this is incredible. And it's just so well done, you know. And it's just so inspiring to – I listen to a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Because I'm always out with my dog. And, you know, I listen to Tara Brach, who's a wonderful Buddhist. She has a podcast that I listen to a lot. And, you know, I listen to NPR or I listen to books on tape. I'm always just has stuff going, you know, to kind of drown out the New York City.
Yeah, I need that too.
And this was a fun, you know, thing because I hadn't really been listening to a lot of fiction podcasts, you know. So I recommend that.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
To check it out.
Yeah, it's cool.
Well, Carrie, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
This was great.
Thank you for listening to the Compass Podcast. If you find these conversations valuable to your life as an artist and would like to support the ongoing production of The Compass, please consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/thecompasspodcast. Pledges start at as little as $1 a month. You'll get access to bonus content, and anything you can give would be greatly appreciated. Also, if you have a moment, please rate or review in iTunes. Every little bit helps other listeners to find the podcast. I'd like to thank the following people for their generosity. The Compass cover art is by Kim Miller, music by Brendan Spieth, audio assistance from Nick Choksi, and a special thanks to Frankie J. Alvarez. See you next time.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.